All right, James, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate you being here.
My pleasure. I can't wait to jump in.
Yeah, man, I've been looking up to you for quite some time, and I'm looking forward to learning from you in a big way.
Thank you.
So first question I have for you, I want to get to know you first as a person, as a human being, if that's okay, because I think that's where we're going to go here with this conversation a little bit. What are some core principles that define you as a person?
Outstanding. Well, I think if you asked anyone, there's this dedication to others. So I'm a big servant leader proponent. To me, that talks about or refers to an idea of shared goals, shared path. So can I serve people who share my goals, and can I lead them down a shared path to those goals? And we think about growth as the mastery of change. So my purpose, if you will, my focus is to serve those who have goals I can serve, who I share, and then walk them down that shared path to change. And if I can do that, I can serve and lead, I can contribute to people's goals, I can have an impact on the world, and I can operate as a growth multiplier, meaning, right, the combination of me and someone else can create a product that is bigger than the sum of its parts. Exactly. That's what I'm all about.
I love that. So give us some perspective on where that derives from, those philosophies, those viewpoints, and kind of how you view yourself that way. What does that stem from in your past?
Yeah. I mean, it's a typical story. This is meaningful to me because when I started my career, I was the exact opposite of that guy. And I tell this.
Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of how a lot of wisdom comes, is through that awareness.
That evolution, right?
Right. Yeah, of doing it the wrong way. Right. So when I got out of grad school, I'd say that I had three strikes against me: the arrogance of my youth, the arrogance of my MBA, and the arrogance of having been raised an entrepreneur. So I was wholly focused on myself and judged and thought I could get by and do my and reach all my goals without relying on anyone else. So I was a pure individual contributor, and I was bound to and a goal of achieving great wealth and great success. And really later in life, after coaching and things like that, I realized that's all driven or found it's a kind of embedded in this idea of the insecurities that I had that defined me, that I allowed to define me. And so for the first 15 years of my career, that's what I did. I pursued things, growth, right? 8 companies, 5 exits, 3 public events, and burned out, and hired a life coach and had that coach for 10 years. Wow. But within about 6 months, became pretty functional, recognizing how the life I had built was antithetical to or in conflict with my core values, was able to make the switch overnight.
Wow.
And if, unfortunately, dude, you know, there were signs throughout those 15 years that I could have paid attention to, but just didn't until in, you know, 2004. And it was Friday the 31st, the last day of the fiscal year. And it hit me and like a ton of bricks. And that was the beginning.
We'll take us to that moment. I mean, that's a lot of people on here are on a journey of their own, and they're trying to learn from past mistakes and be the best leader, consultant, salesperson, whatever. So like, what hit you like a ton of bricks? Because I know I can share some crazy wonker stories as myself.
Right. We all have our story. And that's the beautiful thing, right? That's what allows me to do what I do. When you introduced me and I was able to share what makes me who I am, you know, this idea of service comes from a love of people, right? And the way that I chose to run my life the first 15 years was the exact opposite. I treated people like stepping stones, assets, things to be traded. And I was really, and it really, I went as long as I could, and then, you know, had that realization. So the realization for me came at the high point of my career. I had already been through multiple exits, and I had been the top rep in many companies that I had been part of. This company, I was top rep worldwide, and I got there. I was 330% of my number. I got there in 8 months, And wow. I just worked like a maniac to get there. I took over the worst territory in the world at that time. And I was miserable, and I was earning more money than I had ever made in terms of income, options, all those things were coming to me. I had to reclose a client at the end of that year. Now, my sales approach was whatever it took to get the deal. And so it wasn't uncommon for me to have great clients that loved me, but also have some clients that were not happy.
Because
the transaction was imperative to me. And this client wanted to get out of a deal that he already spent $100,000 on. He's willing to walk away from the money and just to get out of the contract. And my job was to reclose him in front of my boss and my global VP. So that's the epitome of a guy who's operating from a level of insecurity. That's the sweet spot, right? Your boss and your boss's boss are your audience. And now you can put on a show, and your job is to win, not to be a loser, but to be a winner.
And put on an element of display and right.
Right. It's my chance, right?
I'm on stage. And, they're going to notice me.
Yeah. And I was, by the end of the call, I was burping up stomach acid. I felt terrible. And, that evening I got on the computer, I looked up some life coaches, found one, had a call the next day and hired him, and had him for 10 years. Now, I was learning how to coach, because after my awakening, if you will, all I wanted to do was, I recognized that every CEO and sales leader I had ever known needed this. And I wanted to be the practitioner of this level of awareness. And so that's what started.
So you almost had to go through that unknowingly, right? Like you had to go down that path to be prepared to be truly empathetic and have this servant leader mindset, right? I think that's what probably crystallized it for you, is going through that, having the awakening, and then settling on, so you have a story effectively to your journey that's pretty meaningful, it sounds like.
That's correct. And, I am one of these people that has to learn by experience, right? There are people that are raised knowing what I discovered. Mm-hmm. I had to figure out the hard way, and that's just who I am. And one of the things that I would express to anybody on the phone who's, you mentioned this idea of, or on the podcast, you mentioned that we're all, I've gone through a journey, and the listeners have gone through journeys or are going through journeys.
Yeah,
I think that's the key. Every one of us is at a different stage in our journey. And I'm the perfect example of a guy who really wasn't lovable for a long time, but now I'm laying down some good tracks. So, if we can give ourselves the grace that we can learn and change, we can let ourselves off the hook, and we can let other people off the hook. And then we can just take people who they are. And if there's not a fit today, it's okay.
It's okay. Yeah.
They're on their journey. You're on yours. Go. And who knows if your paths will cross again. There doesn't need to be the animosity or the angst or the aggression or the anger or hostility. It just is what it is. Move on. Let's roll.
Right. You mentioned being raised by entrepreneurs, I believe. And I recall you're a fourth generation family business. Is that right?
Well, our generation was the fourth. Yeah.
So that has to be pretty inspiring in itself, but also some big shoes to fill, some high bars to reach. How did that influence your career choices and your path?
Yeah, I think the business was the restaurant business, and my father's heritage is Greek. So we had, we had the big fat Greek family, right? The big fat Greek restaurants, and my parents both had multiple places, and my brother carried on the tradition. Just fell in love with cooking and managing and leading, and has been just had a tremendous career. For me, I only saw the negative sides of the biz, all the things I didn't want to be part of. So, and that influenced a lot of those first 15 years for me. I saw the negative side, meaning my friends that came to work with us at the restaurant stole from us, right? They would just treat our walk-in cooler as their own grocery store and take steaks and lobster and stuff home. And I didn't know this, right? You're always fighting with purveyors. People are trying to give you rotten food. The customers, right, that would be ridiculous and want and not understand, but just be ridiculous and have crazy demands.
Unreasonable.
So, yeah. And I chose to kind of like focus on all the negative. And so it's just a business I didn't want to be in. And I also had, expectations for myself that were beyond, you know, staying local in Buffalo where I was raised. And so after a year after college, I just hit it and I went to Boston and kind of just got exposed to a more global cosmopolitan environment. And that's really what I was craving. And that gave me a platform. My MBA gave me a platform to really be truly entrepreneurial in a consulting world. And then later as a founder, co-founder, sales leader, et cetera.
Right. Did you always know, I mean, at least going to pursue your MBA, was it consulting kind of the path that you were targeting? Did you always kind of know you wanted to be a consultant?
No, I mean, it was the last ditch effort, man. I got my MBA. I met my wife my last day in Boston, then got in my car and came back to Buffalo. And I left school with a business plan, and that plan did not get funded. And so I'm not really a great planner. I'm very much ready, fire aim kind of a guy.
Yeah.
So, So I was bouncing around.
Action biased, as they say.
Yes. And because of those three strikes against me, the arrogance that I had, I was a horrible employee. I was almost fired from all of my internships in grad school. And again, I'm realizing this looking back,
right?
Didn't have the awareness at the time, but I was—
You're in the bubble. It's hard to see what's happening in the bubble when the pattern is ensuing, but you can look back and say, there's a consistent—
You may be looking in the mirror. You may be looking in the mirror, but you're only interpreting the data that you want to look at, right?
Right.
So I was unemployable, my man. So the thing I bounced to was consulting, and I found a mentor who I worked with. I started my own practice. He and I worked together. He taught me how to sell. He taught me a lot of the basics, and was a great, great education. I was able to shadow him for years. And we did big things. I mean, I was the co-host of a radio show 5 days a week during drive time back in the 90s, right? When we were recording radio shows and sending out the shows on cassette tapes and mailing printed newsletters out. You know, that was our thing.
I love it.
So I learned a lot, and it was a great experience. But I just fell into it. Last ditch effort, man.
Interesting. So you started Floris Group 2006, it looks like, when I look at your LinkedIn profile.
Yeah.
And this is 17 years ago after leaving NetSuite, and you were still at Dow Jones and Company, it looks like, because you were there until 2009. So talk about that inflection point, you know, starting your practice while, you know, full-time employed and making that transition and making that jump. I'm sure that's probably consistent with a lot of us where we have an existing full-time role and we're looking to make that jump. Talk about how that started and how you exited into your own practice.
Well, you know, we moved into Columbus from Boston in 06. And so once I became functional, if you will, or healthy, the awareness came pretty easily and the decisions came pretty easily. And so we sold my wife's business, sold our home. We flew to Columbus where my brother was living. So we were getting the family back together. We came here on a Saturday, saw 14 homes on a Saturday and bought number 12 on a Sunday. We were highly organized, highly committed, and
motivated.
Yeah. And
real estate agents dream.
right. Exactly. But I think a message for the listeners too, though, we weren't caught up in, you know, this manifest kind of like days or dream. Like, it wasn't a situation where we, you know, if you believe you can achieve, that kind of thing. This was this was the right move at the right time for the right reasons. And as a result of that, because I was wholly in sync with who I was at the time, what my values were, and every decision I made had no other consideration other than focused on my core values and the things that were important to me and my family. And as a result of that, that synchronicity, that alignment, just made the impossible happen. And it just happened over and over again. And the experience at Dow Jones is one of those examples where, I was involved with a edge company within, so it's a startup in a very old school environment. And I was brought in to help transform the culture. So I was coaching as well as selling, which was great.
Uphill so battle against the grain, against the tide. I mean, old school company transition, it sounds like that would be quite a lift.
Yeah. I didn't look at the challenge. I just looked at the opportunity to kind of work with a big organization and also kind of begin the coaching. And I learned a lot, made a lot of mistakes, made some great friends. It was a great way to transition to this new world of Columbus from Boston, leverage my East Coast connections and start my life. And then just the function of kind of becoming ingrained in the Columbus market allowed me then to focus locally and begin to build my contacts. And that's how that happened.
Did you have clients already in the funnel when you started Florist Group, or did you create it and go out hunting and start building from there?
We just built the company. I had a vision, a level of confidence, and I was used to starting from zero and building a pipeline and reaching 330% of my number within 8 months, in a lot of the places that I work. So I was used to that manic rush without
massive self-belief. That's right.
Right.
It takes a massive amount of self-belief to strike out on your own, period. To do it with no sort of runway, if you will, like client runway, where you have people pent up and ready to go and going into this thing and making it happen. I think what I heard as well, you service 6,500 clients. Is that about right?
More than that, probably closer to 7 grand, but
so
I've just stopped counting.
Yeah. Wow. Humble brag there. Look at that.
No, there are guys that have served way more.
I'm nowhere near you. So I admire that in a big way. But this is 17 years. So, I mean, but talk to me about when you think about the 6,500 or recently, talk to the consultants that are listening that are having a hard time acquiring customers.
Right. I think the thing you said, it must be amazing amount of self-belief. And I think in my case, it's more of a case of ignorance is bliss. So if you think about somebody who is more about ready, fire, aim, who's more action-oriented, damn the torpedoes, I will leap and just not know where I'm going, right? And I kind of be ignorant of the damage or the possibility that could occur right, from making that leap. So I think for me, it was more an alignment with my core values and my purpose, who I wanted to be in the world. And then just not allowing indecision or insecurity to stop me. And I basically funded the marketing simply by buying lunches, dinners, and breakfast. And I was taught this by another one of my mentors. Anybody that ate lunch with me, broke bread with me, they never paid. And so it was easy for me to get people to sit with me. And, every 10 person I met with sent me business. And so
this is the local approach, getting clients in your backyard. Okay.
Yeah. And the hardest thing is doing it online. That's something I haven't perfected yet. That is the approach. And, a lot of us think about the end game. I need this many. Just if you just think about the next one, life becomes a lot easier. You're allowed to focus more. You have less angst. And if you think of this idea that that one in 10 is going to work out, now you can allow yourself to leverage those other 9 sessions or conversations to learn.
Right.
To practice, and you can let yourself off the hook for making mistakes.
Not feeling bad when it doesn't go through. It's almost like, that's all good. It's going to lead me to the next one.
Right. And that's a classic, it's a classic mindset for a salesperson who's going to hear no a lot.
Right.
In this context, I wasn't selling, I was connecting and I was sharing our value prop. And the other thing that I learned to do very early was to remove the barrier for someone to say yes. And if you think about why people say no or why they hesitate to work with you, it's not about you as much as it is about their internal insecurities and their fear. So how do you remove those barriers? Not by making your product bigger or having bigger brand names, but how do you build a relationship that lets them know that you're not going to let them fail? If, for example, failure is the risk, or
you know,
this is not going to blemish my career or cause me to lose face with
you. You must want to diminish that and accelerate or raise up the value, the output, the reward, and then also simultaneously communicate a position somehow, the length of time to said reward, right? If they perceive time to value as being a year from now or something like that, then it's not as compelling as being able to like click a button and get value, right? So yeah, I agree with you 1,000% there. On this, and I'll transition after this question, I want to learn about some things that I know they're near and dear to your heart, but how do you improve as a sales consultant?
Well, look, one of my partners, Chris McAllister, talks a lot about insecurity and proving and hiding, right? So many of us want so much to be thought of as an expert, thought leader. And we invest heavily in that end game. And anything that threatens that end game, that image that we're going for, we want to ignore. We want to either hide from or we prove our way through it. And what you've got to do is you've got to become secure enough in that context. All of us have insecurities, and insecurities actually form who we are.
Right.
What you can do is you can not allow those insecurities to impact the moment. So in a critical moment where, for example, a client might have a complaint or a question or have not had the experience that you wanted them to have, you can either like think to yourself, how fast can I get through this, placate them and move on? Or you can listen with the intent to learn, right? And so the education I got around becoming a coach taught me to remove myself from the solution, guide my client to the best solution that they could create for themselves. So I'm not here to turn you into another version of me.
Right.
I'm here to help you realize your full potential.
And I'm not here to be the hero either. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, my man, I mean, by doing that, I can detach myself from the outcome. And if I truly am committed to being the best possible guide that I can be for my clients, then I want to hear everything. And I'm not going to be insecure about it. I'm going to show up the way I want my clients to show up, open, right? Open to receive without judgment. Now, I'll receive it. Do I listen to it all? Do I process it all? Do I apply it all? I will listen and process, but I will not necessarily apply it. I'll make a conscious decision about whether or not it's true for me, but I'm still receiving. Man, I'll tell you, when your clients experience that from you, they immediately recognize the fact that they don't experience that from so many other people. And it's a huge differentiator beyond your product or your service, just the relationship that they can create with you. It has immeasurable value because it's so hard to find.
Right. You know, it's funny because a lot of times, like when I'm being interviewed and I'm asked about similar questions, I'll talk about the feedback that we provide to clients and the directness sometimes that needs to be packaged in, where we don't want to mince words. We want to make sure we're doing what's best for the organization as a priority. And you know, I always refer to the phrase of like calling someone's baby ugly, right? Sometimes we have to call out and say things that you may not want to hear or necessarily agree with. The thing is, what you're talking about is the opposite, right? Where we're getting feedback from our clients on our practice, the engagement that we've provided, and to not react in that moment and to take it in, be open, process it, whether or not you apply it separate. But I think that's brilliant feedback, because it's that emotional intelligence and that wherewithal that I think a lot of times sets us apart. And so I think it goes to competing through your experience as well. Same thing that we want to do with our products and services and as a software companies or whatever type of company that we have. But as a consultant, it's the same thing. We're competing through our experience. If they can give us feedback and can be pointed with us, and we can process, take that in and have a two-way dialogue about it, as opposed to reacting or cutting the engagement off and saying, I don't like working with you, or whatever might ensue from someone else that they might typically get, a reaction they might normally get. Mm-hmm. I think that definitely sets you apart. Have I always been the best at that? No, not all the time. But I think it's definitely an important area that every client-facing consultant has to be aware of, because it's not just in your direct contact either. It's like sometimes it's the auxiliary personnel in the engagement, right? Where, it might be the salesperson who thinks they have it all figured out, or the marketing person who says things like, well, what do the experts have to say, in a very condescending way, right? And so our ego could get in the way very easily, but if you've done the emotional labor that you've talked about for, the 15 years having the awakening and working on you, if you've done that emotional labor, then when those things arise, you don't react. Great advice. Anything else you might leave maybe a new consultant with?
Yeah. So we hear a lot in sales and consulting and coaching about listening. And I think listening is a great skill set to have. But what oftentimes isn't talked about is, are we asking enough good and tough questions? So the foundation for really what we do is we teach people how to have successful conversations, whether I'm a leader or whether I'm a salesperson. And we think of salespeople as practicing sales as a leadership competency. So if you're a consultant and you're working with a client and you want to move them in a direction that you believe to be in their best interest, what tools do you use? You should be able to have that entire conversation by leveraging questions. And we're not just asking questions until we uncover a need that we can say, aha, now I can pitch. We're asking questions throughout the entire conversation. Hmm. because questions they activate the buyer's mind or your team member's mind or your customer's mind, and it creates engagement. The kind of engagement that you might have when you read a book. Whereas when you're talking like I'm doing right now, it's a passive experience for the listener. And it's easy for them to zone out and not listen.
Right. They don't have to engage. They don't have to really, truly lean into the conversation. Right.
Right. So the best thing you can do is, yes, listen, but learn how to ask enough good and tough questions. And, good questions create awareness in terms of moving someone toward a process or down a path. Tough questions, I have a phrase called the velvet 2x4. Tough questions wake people up. Mm-hmm. Out of their malaise. And they don't have to be just hammered on someone. You can ask someone permission to push back, or maybe ask a controversial question.
James, do you mind if I disagree with you there for a moment?
Go ahead.
No, I'm just playing it out. Oh.
Yeah, you could. Do you mind if I disagree, or may I push back? Right. Or I feel compelled to ask you a question that might rub you the wrong way. Do you mind if I continue?
It's a transitional statement.
Let me know how I did.
Yeah.
All that stuff. But and in a sincere way, because the old me, I would have loved to ask you a question that made you feel defensive, because I wanted to fight.
Right. I can see. I mean, yeah, I was a driver turned influencer. Yes.
Yeah. And exactly. I'm going to roll over everybody in this room. I'm going to focus on the decision maker and get this thing done.
Right.
And everybody else is just in my way.
Right.
So yes, you can be thoughtful.
Velvet 2x4. I love that.
Velvet 2x4. It wakes them up. Doesn't create any long-term damage. But yeah, man. And then what happens when you ask a question that maybe somebody can't answer, or that makes them think in a different way, mm-hmm. guess what? You now are establishing thought leadership. You're not pitching. You're demonstrating your expertise by asking questions they can't answer. Mm-hmm. You're establishing a higher level of expertise faster than you ever could by pitching.
Do you, I think this is a good point to transition, because where my mind goes when I hear that is like an example of working with a client and trying to assess, right? The first phase of most engagements is to go in and do some level of assessment to really gauge what's happening in the business, both people, process, tools, tech, product, the whole nine. But when I think about that and having a conversation with a client contact, the founder, the CEO, the CMO, whoever my primary point of contact is you usually go down the roster and talk about the players on the team. I specialize with SDRs specifically. So if I have a team of 10 SDRs and we're doing a, you know, sort of optimization improvement project, a turnaround, if you will, and you start talking about individual players, then they start talking about low activity. They start talking about how they've been here for a certain period of time. They've never hit their number. And, you know, they just don't quite know why. And I don't know, for whatever reason, the question that comes to mind is, well, why are they still here? You know, it's my point in saying that is really getting, it's a tough question. It's a velvet, you know, if you don't mind me asking, this might rub you the wrong way, but why are they still here then? You know, because it puts them in the seat of like, why aren't you holding them accountable? Why haven't you pulled the trigger? I mean, why haven't you coached them? It really puts them in sort of an accountability seat, which maybe not, might not be the most comfortable, but I think those are the types of line of questioning that we have to be prepared to ask clients. And that might be the best example, but I think that's kind of where I go to when I hear about that. And I think it's phenomenal advice, like it, not just in sales, but in consulting, even more so, being able to really ask take a didactic approach and ask the right questions.
Yeah. And in that situation you described, you can take it to the next level after you ask them, why are they still here? After they give you their explanation, it might make sense to ask another, even tougher question. How much of the problem is you?
Ooh, go ahead, James.
Right?
Yeah.
So yeah. Now you've got to earn the right to ask that question.
Yeah.
But you know, when you think about earning the right to ask tougher questions and raise the tension level in that conversation, you have to accomplish a few things in advance of that. You have to establish a level of understanding and rapport. You have to establish a level of trust. And when you ask a question like that, you're elevating that understanding and trust, or that rapport and trust, to a level of respect. You are earning a level of respect in that conversation that puts the two of you at on par with each other. You are now peers when you ask a question like that. How many of your competitors are able to position themselves as a peer in the same way, just by pitching like everyone else does?
Right.
Well,
I think that's a good setup for one of the areas I want to get into that you've talked about in other shows, but I want to kind of double click on it a little bit. And that's this idea of a reliable sales operating model. And I think that's a goal that we shoot for, and mainly every organization, but the way we get there probably vastly different depending on who you talk to. You've said in other shows that orgs, quote unquote, orgs put too much emphasis on tech and not enough on the person. Another interview that I listened to getting ready for this interview was a quote that you made where only 8% of salespeople follow a reliable sales process. And this kind of gets into what you talk about when you say shifting the mind from tech and heroes. So what is this reliable sales operating model look like? What are those components? The general description. I know it's different probably for every business because we're all unique in our own ways. But when you think about the core components of a reliable sales operating model, what does it look like?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when I was coming up, and I'm not sure if this is true for everybody today, but when I was coming up in sales in the 90s and then 2000s and so forth, we were all told, before we were hired, we were all told to read a book, the sales book of choice for that sales organization you're going to go work for. At the time, I remember being told to read Strategic Selling.
Okay.
And this is when I took my job back in Boston, the first startup that actually had a great IPO and then was later bought and taken public, which was amazing for us all. Strategic selling. And what ended up happening is I walked into an organization that had very little systems. It was an organization that was built on strong individual contributors. And so the idea was, the manager's idea was, look, I'm not going to take responsibility for developing you. I want that book to and that book and your drive and desire to be responsible for you being successful here. And that's how the sales organization was built. What ends up happening in that situation is that the organization can grow by surrounding itself with heroes. And especially if it's venture backed, the organization believes it can afford to throw enough people against the wall to see who sticks and keep the ones around who do. Mm-hmm. The problem is that only takes you so far. And after you get your A round or your B round, at some point, what's going to happen is what got you to where you are won't get you to where you need to go, because you can't possibly throw enough shit against the wall to see if it sticks forever.
Right.
And you can't rely on heroes, because you end up finding that your contacts, your resource pool, your referrals, it gets really thin. And then you start realizing the people that are sending you people really have no earthly idea how good these folks are. Their sense of what constitutes a great producer is way different than yours. Mm. And their experience with them might be with one business that has nothing to do with what you do. And so you really have no insight into how they're going to do in your organization. So what ends up happening is, as we're hiring heroes, we are hiring to fix our business. We're not hiring them to fit our business. When we train to fix the hero that we thought, the person we thought was a hero, not train them to fit a system. We all sell as we all have built our own individual way of selling, right? Think about it. If I give 15 salespeople the same book to read and say, this is our sales model, and I allow them to use their experience, their worldview, their core values, to adapt and adopt that methodology, what will end up happening is you'll have 15 different ways of doing it. And then that manager now has to herd cats, and which is why managers, the first thing they complain about is lack of time management. I have no time to do anything. I'm up until midnight doing reports. Why? Because they have to manage 15 individuals and they're getting no help. Every one of those individuals is working on their own stuff. The idea of a reliable sales operating model says, look, let's think about heroes supported by a system. And let's think about all those individuals voluntarily adopting a system that makes them better. That's the key. And then think about all of them voluntarily adopting a system that makes them better and all contributing now to the development of that system, because they're all bringing their own experiences to that system, best practices, sharing that. Think about the multiplier effect that creates. So now the organization, instead of investing in individual heroes, where, by the way, because those heroes are now working are working with an organization that isn't tuned to support them, they're going to be far less productive in an organization of heroes with no system than they would be with an organization with heroes that are supported by a system. Right. You get a tremendous multiplier effect. When we make that transition for an organization, that organization experiences a 2 to 3x improvement in their growth rate very quickly, because we're optimizing the efficiency of the assets they already have. And we can do that without hiring additional people, without expanding the sales force. What ends up happening is organizations need that venture money and need the ability to grow without being profitable, partly because they're throwing people at a problem and not leveraging those people with pattern recognition and systems thinking that can create that integration and build a foundation to grow from. And the reason it happens in sales, and this is where I'll stop. The reason it happens in sales is because most founders don't get sales. Even if the founder is a salesperson, they may never have built a sales organization, or they may never have done it on their own. And so sales is typically the last place in the organization that gets any systemization.
Right.
And when it happens, dude, what do? We buy tech. We don't develop our people. We go for the fast, easy, you know, I'm going to buy another hero, another solution. We have a tech stack that's huge. And in the meantime, our win rate is going in the toilet.
all the stats that we should be optimizing aren't working because our heroes have hit their ceiling and they're not supported now by an infrastructure that can actually help them achieve more. So what do we do? You know, that's the inflection point that really requires that pattern recognition, that systems thinking to elevate the organization and drive that valuation to the roof.
So where does that start though? Because I mean, cart before the horse type of thing, right?
Right.
You have to experiment. You have to go through the 15 different ways, I would imagine, to settle on the reliable operating model that we know to work in our business. So if I'm a startup, you know, in my first couple of years, maybe encroaching on 10 million and, you know, I'm still figuring this out. I have a handful of salespeople. I have my founder who's still really active on the front lines and helping win deals and save customers. Right. I haven't truly gone through the experimental phase to establish this. So where do you lock in at, I guess?
Yeah. It's a great question. And the answer we've already talked about, right? So when I go to an organization, I think about leaders, people, and systems. And I go back to the question to the CEO, how much of the problem is you? Now, I don't always get a chance to ask that question, but every leader on the planet, every leader listening to this podcast has to recognize that if you have challenges in your organization, you are the one responsible for creating those challenges. Now, the beauty of it, from my perspective, being the outsider who's saying this about you, is that I can see past that. If you created the challenge, guess what? You can fix it.
Right.
That's the amazing, empowering awareness. The challenge is, and challenge comes in so many different ways. If you think about a leader, a sales leader, for example, that built a sales team, and the team hits their number year one, misses their number every quarter in year two. If you're bound by and serving your insecurities, you may not be willing to admit that you have something to learn. You may not be willing, your ego may not be willing to withstand the idea that you have to let someone go who's not hitting their number, who you hired, because letting them go is to admit failure.
Yeah, it reflects on you, right?
Yeah, it reflects on me and my reputation, because I'm so attached to my insecurity and my reputation. I'm not gonna allow that to happen. So what am I gonna do? I'm gonna work harder. I'm gonna coach you more. I'm gonna say that I'm doing this because I don't want to give up on you, right? Because I care about my people. And as a coach, it's my job to figure out really what is motivating this behavior. And people are complex. So I can't diagnose everyone listening at this moment without talking with them. But the idea is that everybody who knows that they're struggling, the place that you can look is your insecurities. And you can think about, how do you identify those? You can think about when you're under stress, when you're facing pressure, when you're in a situation that makes you uncomfortable, asking yourself, why? What is it about the situation that's making me uncomfortable? Yep. You can do some self-diagnosis, but that's the answer.
Introspective work.
It happens up here.
Yeah.
Yeah. We block ourselves. We are the reason that we are not living our potential. And the worst thing we can do is blame the economy or blame our competition or blame our product.
And blame our team. Right? Right. Yeah, exactly.
That takes you further away from accepting responsibility, which is what will get you to that solution.
Love that. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot of discussion that happens around throwing tech at growth. And I think the big topic right now around that is artificial intelligence. So it kind of goes back to this point of, you know, the human component that we were talking about at the start of the interview. And now what you're saying today is putting an emphasis on the people and the systems before the tech. So what's your just 30-second perspective on AI and sales today and where we're going with that?
Well, I love technology. I love AI. When I need it, I use it. Now, it's, of course, I don't love the fact that it comes up with phantom data oftentimes.
Yeah. ChatGPT fill right. in the blank.
Yeah. I mean, it drives me nuts, but you know, I've learned a long time ago, you don't judge someone by expectations they can't fulfill, right? You don't right. judge the turtle for their ability to climb a tree, right? So you've got to understand that tech, like you understand people for who they are or what it is. But you've got to, you can't deny that growth is the mastery of change. And tech is driving a lot of change. And if you want to grow, you can't ignore, not only can you not ignore tech, you can't decide that you're not going to learn how to master it.
Right. You can't not embrace it at this point. You
can't not embrace it, right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So do you think that salespeople to a degree or headcounts will be, you know, cut in half? Like, just talk about displacement of the human.
Yeah. I love this conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it comes up everywhere. You can't ignore it. I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask about AI pretty much every interview. So yeah. Like, do you think it's going to take salespeople's jobs in the near term?
Yeah. I remember I grew up, dude, I got out of grad school and I was lugging around a Mac, right? That was like 20 pounds. So I've come from that. I rejected, you know, I kept my DOS, you know, when Windows came out. I mean, I fought all of it all along the way. And then as I came through, I was part of end-tier client server, object-oriented databases. I was part of the original on-demand world before SaaS was a thing. I mean, I've been part of all this
emerging technology.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I just can tell you, four recessions, right? So I can tell you, every time something changes, it's like, who's going to be displaced? And it's like sales. You know, salespeople suck. You know, you're going to be displaced by websites that are going to sell for you. And what I'll tell you is this, the same is true every time the same thing is true. Those of us who are transactional, who operate in a way that is more mechanistic and more logical, yes, we're at risk, man, because you can easily be replaced.
Right.
You listen to the people who talk about AI in the context of art, in the context of business.
Right.
AI will never be as creative as us. So what I'm going to suggest to you is that the salespeople
who have nothing. I don't know, man. I don't know.
Well, no. In terms of, think about it. And I firmly believe. I may be wrong. I firmly believe that the best of us, in terms of who we are as salespeople, those of us who recognize other person's humanity, who work toward a shared goal, and can lead someone down a shared path, those of us who take on the most complex, personal relationships.
Right.
I don't think that's ever going to be, you know, who knows, man.
No, I agree. That firmly agree with. But yeah. I do think that there is a buyer out there that, just like we've been conditioned to buy differently today, like my mom is buying stuff, her groceries, on an app on her phone. She would have never thought that would be a thing, right? And she's in her 60s and she's doing this, right? And so, you know, I think we are evolving as buyers, which drives the sales context. And buyer, I think there's a buyer out there that would just rather deal with a bot, either even in a context like this. If you're going to give me a demo over Zoom or whatever equivalent we have in the future, maybe it's in some virtual reality world or something. But the idea of working a human, having a transaction of a complex nature with in the bot.
So check this out. So two things, and I know we have to get wrapping, but two things to think about. One is, you know, if we assume that people don't like the sales interaction, then it may be true that they're running for help. Here's my belief: people love to buy as much as they hate being sold, and people love being taken care of and being treated as a one of one. If I reject people and human beings, I don't want to talk to them because I don't trust them, then I may be more inclined to use a bot. But the issue is going to be same with a person. Am I willing to make this complex, risky decision that puts my career, my reputation, money, the future of my business at risk on a relationship with a computer? Or am I going to want to have an individual and a team of individuals behind them, you know, helping to assure me that I'm going to be successful? Where am I going to put my faith? Today, I say the most complex, risky decisions that make buyers the most insecure are still going to want to be solved through strong relationships with individuals who know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree 100%. The transactional stuff, the small ticket stuff.
Low risk.
Yeah.
You know, commoditized. And a lot of companies today, they're allowing their sales forces to commoditize their own products. And it's because it's easier to run a team that's more transactional. But if you're not selling value and you're not bolstering the value of your organization, the value of your people, then you're just assisting AI in taking over those roles. And you're really killing the future of your business. You're commoditizing it before it's time. You're costing yourselves billions and billions of dollars of lost value. So it does make sense to invest in a more thoughtful way to go to market, to sell, and to move away from that easier, quote unquote, easier, more transactional approach.
Oh, powerful message. And thank you for going there with me and entertaining the AI conversation. But I think this has been super enlightening on many fronts. Where do you want to send people to learn more and follow you?
Check me out on LinkedIn, James, last name is Rores, R-O-R-E-S, or florisgroup.com, F-L-O-R-I-S-S-group.com.
You've been listening to the Sales Consultant Podcast. If you enjoyed the interview and would like to support the show, please be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and or on Spotify. Please also consider following our LinkedIn page. If you're an industry expert or if you know an industry expert that should be on the show, message us on LinkedIn at the Sales Consultant Podcast.